This is the rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Coming up on the show, as Florida's drought continues, the risk of wildfires is increasing. And later, a new store in Newberry specializes in all things Lego bricks. But first, you may remember that railroad tie fire in Dunellen earlier this month. Well, we have an update. Preliminary results of water quality testing in the area are back. It's important to note water testing has been handled mostly by independent contractors hired by CSX Transportation. That's the company that owns the land where the ties were stored. So far, contamination levels have not exceeded state safety limits, but that may not be the full story. Jennifer Hunt Murdy with the Ocala Gazette has been reporting extensively on this since the fire took place and has been looking into some of the gaps in the testing. I spoke with her earlier about what she found.
So I was on scene the day of the fire, and I started getting calls at around 6 o'clock that morning. I had been following the story, and watching the site, because we were, you know, very concerned that this would happen. When I got to the site, probably around 9 o'clock, the fire was still raging. The plume of smoke was large. And one of the things I report a lot on public safety, and one of the things I noticed while I was there was I'm watching all of these people with Mayor Green communicate on whether communities needed to be evacuated, what needed to be mobilized. What struck me at the time is I was asking questions about who was in charge of the scene when it came to investigating the start of the fire, what caused the fire. And I couldn't get a clear answer just to that one question, which alarmed me. So I started asking for the data that they relied on in making decisions. I assumed that they were making decisions based on scientific environmental testing. I learned within a day or two that everybody was basically winging it. And the only people that were testing were the CSX contractors. And that they had set up this hotline that CSX oversees that anybody with concerns could call. So I called because I was around the fire, you know, probably 7-8 hours. And they basically said that all of the air testing has come back safe. So if I had any symptoms, to call them back. It has taken weeks to get analysis from any of these agencies. And so what I've tried to do is just keep gathering it and posting it so that the public knows the data themselves to make decisions. Like, I just updated my story on water to explain that the health department has tested 7 wells over a week's period. These wells were within 0.5 mile of the site, and they still don't have those testing results back.
And so how are people who live in Dunellen reacting?
Very frustrated. One gentleman who lives on the Rainbow River and is one of those wells, private wells, within 0.5 mile from the site, he knows they tested his well, and they promised him they're going to monitor it for a year, yet he still doesn't have the results of that testing. So he was frustrated. Many of the Dunellen residents who've come to meetings have expressed dismay, a lack of sense of urgency, and a lot of distrust in CSX basically monitoring cleanup efforts themselves. They would prefer either the state or local government take lead in independent testing.
In the course of your reporting, have you found that it's normal for companies involved in these big environmental events to monitor the cleanup themselves?
I was told by the attorney who represents a lot of the agencies that have been actively pushing back against CSX that it is not uncommon for state authorities to allow corporations to present a plan for cleanup. And that's what happened here. However, CSX has decided to appeal Denellen's code enforcement orders, and now also a class action suit has been filed for residents of Denellen. And basically, it's asking for court-ordered medical monitoring for any claims that they might have. They're asking for a trust fund to be set up for people that have medical conditions. So it's going to be very interesting to see how residents' complaints are handled. The county and the city of Denellen have said they are going to file a lawsuit for injunctive relief. That has not been filed. So there's a lot still hanging up in the air.
What can we expect to see in the coming weeks as the investigation continues and cleanup continues? Do you have any sense of what is coming down the pipe, as it were?
Well, under the plan approved by the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, no further water testing is in the works unless soil testing comes back with certain indicators that they need to create wells for monitoring water. And I think that's one of probably the biggest concerns of everybody is they pumped, you know, 1 million gallons of water on this fire. How long does it take to get to wells for the river? It will be interesting to get those soil samples to see what choices they make after. It might help us that we haven't had a lot of rain while this cleanup is happening, because they've been able to take a lot of the contaminated soil away, but we just don't know. And so I think everybody's concerned that the testing to date has not been thorough enough to give us clear indicators about what is going to be in the long-term best interest, the public's best interest for monitoring.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Anytime.
That was Jennifer Hunt Murdy, a reporter with the Ocala Gazette, who's been covering the Denellen rail tie fire. A statement from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection from earlier this month reads, quote, "Based on current sampling, there is no indication of a threat to public health. So far, the investigation into what caused the fire is still ongoing." If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Florida has a lot of stories to tell. Do you know your community's history? It's time for a trivia question. The Sunshine State is known for its white sand beaches and gator-filled swamps, but another environment is also abundant here, freshwater springs. While the exact number is not known, roughly how many springs does Florida have? Is it A, around 600? B, around 1,000, or C, around 2,500. Stay tuned to the end of the show for the answer. Still to come, we dig into Florida's wildfire risk as drought conditions worsen. That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. This winter, Florida has experienced one of the worst droughts in years. If you live in North Central Florida, you may have heard a voicemail from local officials, something similar to this.
Due to severe drought conditions and increased wildfire activity across Florida, Governor DeSantis has declared a state of emergency that includes Alachua County. A countywide burn.
WUFT reporter Gabe Vargas has been looking into what this wildfire risk means for Floridians. Gabe, are wildfires a normal occurrence here in the state of Florida?
So in short, yes, wildfires are completely normal in the state of Florida. I spoke with David Godwin. He's the director of the Southern Fire Exchange at UF IFAS, and he says wildfires burn over 1 million acres of land in the state every year. A lot of the plants here in the state actually have oils and resins that allow them to be more flammable. They've evolved over the years to allow the landscapes here to burn naturally. Godwin compares fires in Florida to being nature's lawnmower. It keeps the plants and animals in an ecosystem healthy, similarly to how mowing the lawn keeps your grass healthy.
So if these wildfires are normal, why did Governor Ron DeSantis put over 35 counties in that state of emergency?
Well, so what's not normal is the drought we've been experiencing throughout the state. Though we've had some rain come through within the past few weeks, most areas in North Central Florida are facing a rain deficit of nearly 14 to 16 inches from normal levels. So you combine this with hard freezes and windy conditions, and the risk for wildfire is incredibly high. The busiest time of the wildfire season is during March, April, and May as the winds pick up and the rain becomes even more scarce. So the biggest risk for fires historically is still ahead.
So we hear a lot of news stories about wildfires across the country. How is Florida different from, say, California or Washington?
So here in Florida, we have unique layers of material in the soil called, and yes, you're hearing this correctly, muck and duff. And they sound like foreign birds from another planet. And it contains about 20 to 50 feet of decaying organic vegetation. This material is found in lake beds, dried up swamps, essentially everywhere within the state of Florida. Dr. Ludi Bond is a wildfire mitigation specialist with the Florida Forest Service, and she says that the vegetation in this soil, called ground fuels, is extremely flammable.
Fire can begin to burrow and tunnel underground to feed on that vegetation. It's not uncommon for dry swamps, dry lake beds, and prairies to burn for days, weeks, even months underground because of these dry conditions.
These underground fires produce massive amounts of smoke that can reduce visibility on areas like roads to nearly zero.
That sounds incredibly dangerous. What can people do to mitigate some of the risks associated with these fires?
Yeah, well, in most circumstances, wildfires like this occur due to carelessness. Something as little as throwing a smoldering cigarette butt can start a fire of drastic proportions in conditions like these. So exercising caution and adhering to the burn bans set by local authorities is an absolute must when conditions are like this. People can monitor active wildfires throughout the state on this cool online interactive map provided by the Florida Forest Service. This and all other information pertaining to wildfires in the state can be found by a simple Google search like Florida Wildfire Map. Usually the first link that comes up says current wildfire information on the Florida Department of Agriculture's website. It contains everything you need to know about the current wildfire situation.
WUFT's Gabe Vargas, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me here.
In Palatka, before the birds are even awake, many times you can find 17-year-old fisherman Blandon Austin. When WUFT's Shania Williams spent a day with him, she found he was using a lot of different techniques, all in the hopes of landing a really big fish. She has this story as part of this audio postcard.
My first rod that I ever got was a small ice rod that they used to sell in Walmart, and that's what they gave me. So I caught my first ever fish. I can't really remember the name of it, but that shaped me to what I am now from all the rods I have to catch bigger fish. My name is Blandon Austin. I am in 10th grade.
So right now I'm throwing a chatter bait around to imitate a bait fish swimming around. And it vibrates really loud in the water, so it irritates the fish a lot more. And usually they'll hit it. Whenever they start chasing, they'll start schooling sometimes around it. And if there's more bait fish schooling, there'll be a lot more chasing. And this puts out a lot more action and vibration in the water. So it attracts them a lot more, and it has a gold blade on it, so it flashes around too, and it catches their attention.
Who sparked my love for fishing? That was my family, my parents. They brought me on the water ever since I was 4 months old. They've had me fishing since I was three, and I've just always enjoyed it. Every time they go out, they brought me. I got to spend time with them and catch fish.
I'm trying to get up around these docks because that's where they're hiding up against the structure. So the structure, you got your seawall, which is that wood wall right there. And then you got all the boat ramps and stuff. So you got the pillars in the water, ladders, trash, whatever they have in the bottom there. And the fish will hide up around there and wait for bait fish to come around. how often am I fishing? So I go out as much as I can. Usually if I have time during the weekends, I'll go out there for a full day. But if I don't and I just have a little bit of, for a couple of hours, for like a day, I'll go out to the community center and fish around there for a little bit. Ooh, here we go. Fishy spot. I have a different bait on each rod. And each rod has its, in my opinion, has its own finesse. A spinning rod is more from, a finesse rod has more tip action to it. Bait caster has more backbone to it. Oh, it's a good one.
So why I chose fishing was because it's something I was growing up doing ever since I was like 3 years old. And I've always enjoyed being out in the wild and nature and stuff like that. And it's something that most people don't get the experience and do.
Yes, okay. Yeah, that's three pounder. I'm living life to the fullest right now, right?
Yeah, you got him.
That was 17-year-old Blandon Austin fishing in Palatka. His story was produced by WUFT's Shania Williams. You can find more of Shania's work, along with a photo of Blandon and the fish he caught, at our website, WUFT.org/FM. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. As a reminder, our trivia question this week, while the exact number isn't known, roughly how many springs does Florida have? Is it A, around 600, B, around 1,000, or C, around 2,500? The answer's coming up at the end of the show. That's after a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Think back to when you were a kid. At playtime, what toys did you play with? For millions of kids and former kids, the answer includes Legos. Well, people in Alachua County and beyond can now trade and sell them at a small store that just opened called Bricks and Minifigs. WUFT's Carlos Corzo visited the shop to see what drove owner and Lego enthusiast Kurt Kasluskas to open his shop.
I decided to open this Bricks and Minifigs after a travel baseball trip with my son to South Florida, where we stopped in a bunch of these on the way. I had never been in one before. And by the time we got to the fourth one, I was scanning a QR on the wall that said, "Do you want to be a franchisee?" My kids are growing up. Without kids, I'm less busy. So I said, you know, it seemed like this town was a perfect place for this store. And the feedback I've gotten has just been tremendous. Everyone in the community has just been so great. People are thanking us for opening this there here, saying that, well, I don't have to drive to Orlando anymore. I don't have to drive to Jacksonville anymore. So it's very exciting to bring this to Gainesville.
What is it exactly about Gainesville that, well, rather drew you to opening up here?
You know, with the medical community, the university community, both the students and the people that work at the university, it struck me as that's the type of demographics that would be into Lego, like their kids playing with Lego. And given the turnout and feedback we've gotten, I think I was correct.
Yeah, it's actually quite busy in here. And obviously, it is a Saturday, so, I mean, the kids have the opportunity to come here, not on a school, or rather a weekday. Has foot traffic been like this steadily since you opened?
It's been steady since we opened. We're having a real good first week. You know, the grand opening was tremendous. The line at one point was down, I mean, almost a quarter mile, 3 hour wait.
And what has been your favorite part of the opening process?
Just seeing everybody so excited to have this here. And I love it when I, you know, get the thank yous. Before the store opened, I was walking in one morning to set up, and a guy pulls up with his teenage son in the car, and then the dad's just like, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." It really made me feel good. I'm glad to, you know, make it more accessible for everyone to so they can find the stuffs that, you know, what they like with Lego. That's what's so great about Lego. There really is something for everyone.
Would you say that Lego making and Lego building is kind of a lost art form? And By that same right, do you feel like opening the store is restoring some of that to the community?
I don't feel like it's a lost art form, only because I think interest in Lego has grown and is continuing to grow. More and more people are getting into it. I do think it's much needed in this age of electronics, like you said. Like, this is such a better outlet for our youth. You know, I mean, they, well, you see all the studies now, you know, looking at the screen all the time, where taking a Lego set, having the patience to flip through directions, build it step by step, is the complete opposite of that. It teaches patience, perseverance, finishing a job to completion. It's just an amazing product.
Could you, in a couple words, describe what is happening here? Like what you see, and like the faces, the camaraderie, all that.
People having fun doing what they love.
And love really is the word for it. After I spoke with Kozlowskis, I saw children playing with figurines and eagerly picking through piles of small bricks. One of them was 11-year-old Ritvija. So do you have like a favorite Lego set, by any chance?
I don't know. I think I like the Friends Legos, but I don't know my favorite set, really.
I see right here you're just collecting like little figurines. Do you have like a creative vision that you want to do with these? You want to like build something?
Yeah, I'm going to, like, I'm trying to make me out of these, trying to find some that look like me.
Yeah. Have you been like collecting or building Legos for a while now?
Kind of. Yeah, we like the Flowers Legos and also the Friends ones.
That's perfect. Thank you very much. It's great to meet you.
That was WUFT's Carlos Corzo and his walk through the new Lego trading store, Bricks and Minifigs, in Newberry. The Rundown is a production of WUFT News out of the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications. The team that made this show possible this week includes Dave Bereswain, Dana Hill, Gabe Vargas, Shania Williams, and Carlos Corzo. Special thanks to the Dean of the College, Hub Brown, and Interim Newsroom Director, Ethan Majok. Do you have comments or questions about the show today or ideas for future shows? Email us at therundown@wuft.org or tap the Talk to Us button on the WUFT mobile app to leave us a voice message. We may feature your voice on the show. Our trivia question this week was, while the exact number isn't known, roughly how many springs does Florida have? Is it A, around 600, B, around 1,000, or C, around 2,500? The answer? B, around 1,000. 30 of them are listed as outstanding Florida springs as part of the Florida Springs and Aquifer Protection Act. This requires additional protections to ensure their conservation and restoration for future generations. That's it for the Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina.